The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So on many of the Mondays for the last few months that I've given talks here, I have monopolized the Dharma talk time with just talking and talking and talking. And hopefully it's been worthwhile that I've done that. And in the last 4 Mondays, I've given a series of talks, a kind of introduction to Buddhism talk. And I thought that after all this talking and all this introduction to Buddhism that I've done, that it'd be nice and valuable to give you a chance to ask questions the way we didn't have during those talks, or make comments or say something in relationship to it. And for those of you who weren't here, I thought I would start first with doing a little bit of introductory words or some few things. And that had a little bit to do with kind of an overview or introduction to Buddhism from a little different angle. And that is that Buddhism is often held up in the academic study of religion as being the exception when people are trying to define what religion is. Because it's quite common in religious studies departments, people do the exercise among graduate students to please define what religion is, or undergraduates, to give a definition. And commonly, they'll have some reference in the definition to belief in a god or gods. And then people say, well, that definition doesn't work because of Buddhism. Buddhism is kind of like a thorn in the side of people trying to define what religion is. And so that's a very interesting. But what I wanted to say here is that when there's a theistic religion and people are trying to decide how to practice or what their life is about or what the purpose of life is about, it's relatively common to have... can people hear okay? Everybody hear okay? Okay. It's relatively common for people to... into theistic religion, to have some kind of ultimate authority that's transcendental, like you have this authority of God, that somehow or other we've divined what God thinks or wants, but there's some kind of purpose or value in life that's being transmitted from some other source. So like the Ten Commandments, you know, came from some other source and came to us, and this is how you're supposed to live. Or there's this goal of a heaven, which is beyond this life, and in order to, and you're obligated, there's an obligation in a sense to live a certain way because this is what the God says or theistic religious approach is. And so there comes kind of sense of, some people take on this sense of obligation. This is what's proper, this is what's important, this is what God wants. And there's a lot can be said about that source of authority and the nature of it. But since Buddhism doesn't have a God in that kind of way, it doesn't posit a God that is beyond this world that assigns a set of obligations or commandments or to us about how we're supposed to live our life. Then the question in Buddhism is, what is it that we, how is it we find the good life? Or how is it we find what is the proper way or the worthwhile way or the meaningful way to live a human life? If it's not going to be defined elsewhere by someone else. And so what we find in Buddhism, then, is that there's many ways in which that's defined, but there's a lot, big emphasis in Buddhism, in the early teachings of the Buddha, on understanding our life from the very simple principles of what's called sukha and dukkha. And sukha is sometimes translated as happiness, and dukkha is sometimes translated as suffering or unhappiness or something like that. But those two terms, sukha and dukkha, also mean a pleasure and pain. And there's a kind of a spectrum of meanings of those two words. And they kind of morph between them as the Buddha talks in different contexts. And it's the Buddha refers to that over and over again. And if you listen to the Dalai Lama, he'll also say that everybody, all humans, what they have in common is a pursuit for happiness. That somehow the pursuit of happiness is some kind of offer, some kind of ultimate good and commonality that we all have. We might have different definitions of what happiness is or how it's attained, but we have that in common. And so you see, from the Buddha to all the way to the Dalai Lama, an attempt to try to organize or understand human life from these very simple ideas of happiness and unhappiness. And then the question is that the Buddha asked himself, or what he offered to us, is what is it that leads to real happiness or true happiness or lasting happiness? And if you're not going to find that defined by some external source, then we have to use whatever resources we have in ourselves to find out what that is. And so Buddhist practice becomes an exploration and a discovery of what is it that brings us suffering and what is it that can bring us not only happiness in conventional ways, but in kind of unconventional ways in terms of something that's lasting, feels much more true and is more stable than the kind of happiness that can come from, you know, having things go the way you want them to go in, you know, in our life. So this idea, some people would then protest that if you analyze or look at your life, evaluate your life from the point of view of happiness and unhappiness, that seems pretty unreligious. It doesn't seem very ultimate. It also seems very subjective. It also might seem somewhat hedonistic or selfish. That's what life's supposed to be about happiness. And there must be greater goods than that. What about living a compassionate life or living a life benefiting others? And the Buddhist analysis of that is that if you live a hedonistic life or a selfish life, that hurts. And so you'll feel that suffering. And you can't get really true and lasting happiness from being selfish or being hedonistic. And so there's a self-corrective move within the very practice to free us from those kinds of unfortunate kind of things. And the last thing I'll say is that I'm very fond that the wording of the core Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the teaching about the suffering, the cause of suffering, and in a sense, happiness and the cause of happiness, the wording of that in the original language has no pronouns connected to it. So that means that what we do is, in Buddhism, we study suffering. And it doesn't say study your suffering, it just study suffering. And so I feel it's very open in system where the call is notice suffering wherever it happens to be in your field. If it's within you, study that. If it's in your family or in your neighborhood or in your city, become attentive to that as well. And then study the causes of it, the suffering. So study it in yourself and also study it in the world around you. And then study or discover or develop happiness. And not just, it doesn't say just do it for yourself. It's open. It includes the whole world. And so this idea that, at least what the Buddha is pointing to, is a way of discovering happiness and being free from suffering that is not just self-centered, but it involves a mutual concern for oneself and for others. And in fact, if at some point in practicing, if your concern for practice is just about yourself and your own lasting happiness, I don't think it's going to be a true and lasting happiness. There has to be some openness, some receptivity to others, and attunement, sensitivity to others. And that part of our understanding and motivation is for the welfare of others as much as it is for the welfare of ourselves. So that was my attempt to offer you some introductory words for those of you who are new, as we kind of open it up here. And if any of you have any questions about what I've said over the last few weeks, or protests or comments, this is a good time.
I'd like to protest. I mean, something occurred to me last week, and I was just thinking about how I would put this, and because it was very clear to me when you were talking, and then I thought about it, and now I forgot what it was. So, I remember basically what it was, but you were talking about walking on the beach, and using a really nice metaphor, an example of, you know, finding, being removed from sort of the pace of our life and the pressure of our life and the caught upness. And what had occurred to me is that there's discomfort in separating from that. There's discomfort in the practice, in the pursuit of allowing the present to be in your life, because, you know, what I found is I just got to let go of just so much stuff that is in my conscious and my unconscious about what values are and what the purpose is in this life. Because we've been raised in this Western, hedonistic, illusion-packed thing, culture, and we've all become victims of a huge, complex marketing ploy and believed it on some levels. And there's pain in letting that go. There's there's discomfort in letting it go. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But it seems... It seems wrong sometimes because of that pain, because you know what I mean? So yeah. I'd like if you would kind of speak to that a little bit.
Beautiful. It's well said. So thank you. And I mean, it's more than just because we get caught by the marketing schemes. Sometimes people are very much attached to familiarity, to what the familiar do. And what's been their companion for decades. So a certain suffering even. Some people don't want to give up the certain suffering because it's how they've oriented themselves to their life. It's the way that they found meaning in their life, the way that they have identity in their life. And without that suffering, who would they be? How would they find themselves? Why would they find meaning? And so not only is it painful, but it can be very frightening sometimes, the idea of letting go. And partly last week, I tried to describe this process, especially going down the beach, and try to do it in a positive sense, in the sense that rather than focusing on letting go, I was trying to, in a way, to focus on the opening up to. And if you just talk about letting go, it can just seem like it's pure pain, just the deprivation. But the other side of letting go is you're opening to. So you're just opening to more and more wonderful, you know, something really, really spacious and wonderful. And it might be more useful for some people to talk about the letting go process as an opening to. And then if it is painful, then there's a couple of things. One is if we can have our sights on what's beautiful or in the letting go process, or, then the beauty can be a balance to the pain of letting go of something and give us courage and strength. Sometimes it's very helpful to know that you're not alone in that process, that it's a well understood process of grief sometimes, of what we have to let go of, and pain. And if you know you're not alone, it's not strange, it's kind of normal, then it's easier to go through it. Sometimes people even do rituals. When they have to let go of something, it's really, you don't want to let go of, it's very painful to let go of. Sometimes a ritual, farewell, it speaks to some deep part of the mind that other things can't speak to. And so a ritual can make the transition for some people. Some of it has to do with having some wisdom or good understanding about what the process is. So then there's and the skill to know how to be present for discomfort. And one of the great strengths that can come from mindfulness practice is learning how to be present with patience and equanimity with very uncomfortable situations. And so if it's personally uncomfortable that way, to have the ability to hang in there with it and wait until it passes through. It also helps to have some understanding that all these things, our discomfort, are processes, not static fixed things. And so if we allow ourselves to be present for it and kind of get out of the way, then we can allow the process, the activity, to play itself out or to unravel. But if we hold on to it or cling to it, then we freeze it, and then it might stay there for a long time. So to realize it is a process sometimes is very helpful for some people. And also I think it's helpful to be very patient. Some of these things that, I mean, we listen to Buddhist teachers sometimes, it seems like they're expecting it to be really easy. you know, just let go and everything will be fine. As if it's easy to let go and easy to be mindful. But some of these, we have to have a tremendous respect at the power or the strength of some of the things we cling to or hold on to and how we relate to it because of, you know, lifetime habits, familiarity, comfort, value, meaning, you know, everything. The whole world is kind of based on a certain clinging. And so to realize that we might need a lot of patience to slowly work through it and find our way. So that's what occurs to me in response. Is that does that speak to what you asked, or?
Yeah. And the thing also that I was reflecting on is that it's so helpful to have teachings that have been written down, that people have walked this path for thousands of years, basically, and I just think, as a Westerner, our experience with it, because of our culturalization, it's a little tricky in some ways that may not be for past cultures because of the complexities of what we are living in.
Many people have said that, and it's possible. I don't know. It's easy to kind of make that look and see that might be so. But when you read the teachings of the Buddha, and how he had to teach the same thing over and over again, I think that it must have been a pretty big issue for them as it is for us, some of these things, like attachment to self. And there were people who heard what the Buddha had to teach and walked away angry. You know, so it wasn't like everyone was just receptive to what he had to say. And there was a psychologist here in America who did a lot of Buddhist practice. And he suggested that all spiritual practice can be understood as a process of grieving, which would speak to what you're talking about. And I don't really agree with him with that generalization, that it's all grieving. However, I think that grieving can often be a part of it for some people, and some more than others. And some of it has to do with individual minds or dispositions of how we are, and who knows why we are how the way we are. But some people focus more on where they're going, and some people focus more on where they're leaving. So for some people, their suffering is so great that that's what they're focusing on, and for some people, the light that they're going towards is so bright that that's what they notice. They don't notice the suffering they're working through or letting go of, and so not like one is right or wrong. It's just people have different ways of, you know, focusing and paying attention. And so for those people who kind of tend to focus more on what's being left behind rather than what's gained, it can be a little more painful process. Those people who focus more on what can be gained sometimes can be a little bit naive. You know, kind of make mistakes, you know, because they don't really see what's happening here. It's a great concern.
I have a question. I always thought that I was a very patient person, but somehow I'm not, I think. And I've thought about this word, patience, a lot lately, and I was wondering, I don't know, my definition is kind of gone. I don't know why.
Oh.
Yeah, it's, I was wondering if, about... Maybe your definition of patience or somebody's.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I'll repeat something that I said Friday. For those of you who are here, I apologize. I think of there's two kinds of patience. There is the patience which requires activity on our part, something we do, and patience which requires nothing from us. And I mean it this way. The two people find themselves in a very trying situation. Same situation. And from our perspective of looking at them, both of them look really patient. They're sitting there really quietly. They're not reactive. They seem calm. And we say, oh, those people are patient. Boy, are they patient. Can't believe it. Those kids are just screaming and yelling and fighting. And it seems impossible to keep them under control. And you know they need to get food in order to get them to quiet down, but they're just like so crazy you can't get them fed. And so it's pretty, you know. And they say, well, that's amazing. Those two people, they just say, it seems very difficult, and they're just calm and peaceful through it all. Then you go inside the mind of both people. Or you ask them, and they tell you. And one of them says, boy, those kids, they pushed all my buttons. It was like I was about to, you know, strangle them. And but I just kind of really mustered a lot of inner strength and fortitude. And it took a lot of work for me to stay non-reactive. Really not, you know. And I stayed calm. I breathed a lot. I let go of a lot. I noted my reaction. I felt my discomfort. And by doing all this kind of mindfulness work, I could stay present and not react. And that's why I look calm. So the person's pretty calm, non-reactive. The other person stayed calm because that person had no buttons that could be pushed. And so there was no effort needed to try to, you know, be non-reactive and understand what was going on. It was just like, you know, nothing was pushed, you know. Both of them externally behaved the same, but internally very different. The one who had no buttons to be pushed looked patient, but it was a non-existent patience because it wasn't a doing. The person didn't have to do anything to be patient. The first person, it was a doing patience because they had to do something in order to maintain patience, to be non-reactive. And I define patience as kind of being non-reactive under trying situations. And as people practice, the shift goes from patience or non-reactivity being a doing to being a non-doing. Is that interesting for you? Yes.
Many months ago,
there's three settings on that mic, and you have to switch it all the way over to.
Can
one
you
side.
Hear me now?
There.
Many months ago, I spoke about, I discovered something, and I asked you about how our economy is built on fear and security. You know, basically, if you don't buy this acne cream, nobody's going to love you. And I said to myself, I asked you, like, what if everybody tomorrow becomes enlightened and our economy would collapse? And I told you about how that kind of frightened me, that the economy would collapse.
Mm.
But then, like, you know, months later, and I kept thinking about this, and I said to myself, well, if everybody's enlightened tomorrow and the economy collapses, no one would mind.
That's right. If everybody got enlightened tomorrow, we wouldn't need the economy the way it is. And, for example, I think people would live a lot simpler than they do now. And so it would be disastrous to some of the consumer companies that we have. They would just go bankrupt. But the people who go bankrupt, they're enlightened. So they realize that we don't need this either. And the basic things that we need in order to support each other and have a good life, successful life, can be accomplished through a lot less effort than all the effort that goes into making, just weapons, just that by itself. And not only that, but there's enough goods being made on the earth. We can reduce the production and still have enough if we distribute it nicely, that everyone would be quite comfortable in a way that they're not now. And, you know, like half the population of the world survives on less than $2 a day. You know, it's some people spend more on their coffee than some people have to live on for a whole day.
Well, anyway, I just wanted to share that. And I also want to share with everybody, like, about this website called kiva.org. I'm sure a lot of you know about it. I just discovered about it. It's basically, it's a micro-lending site, and people like us, regular people, can lend people in third world countries, you know, as little as $25 to expand their business or start a new business.
Oh, beautiful. The whole micro-lending thing is a beautiful thing that's done to the world. So thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. First of all, it was really interesting, the one on the question about patience and your example. I have two young, very rambunctious, very active, very emotionally intense boys. And my friends consider me one of the most patient moms they know. But inside, my buttons are being pushed like crazy. So, and there was a scenario just one night that was exactly like the kids were going nuts. And I was completely patient. And then my little one turned his rice upside down. I picked up what was left and I threw it across the room very patiently. And then I kept feeding them. So patience is all relative. My question, I've been studying for practicing for maybe about a year now. And I find it kind of interesting that Buddhism seems to assume that people are generally good.
Mm.
And I want to know. And I say that because, you know, because through the process of, because of the focus on contemplation and observation and my own experience, it seems to bring out the best, my best nature. And it seems to assume that if you follow this practice, that it will continue to bring out the best nature as opposed to some uglier side. And I was just wondering what your take on that is.
I agree. the whole thing about, you know, Buddhism tends not to make some, at least early Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha, to make some kind of absolute statement about the nature of human beings. This is the way the true nature, the essential nature is. The idea of essential tends to be, the ideas of essential tends to be avoided in this tradition because everything's in process. But I think it's helpful to think that there's almost like two different natures. And to use Buddhist terms, we have a nature to be a Buddha, Buddha nature. And but we also have the nature to be Mara, which is like the Buddhist devil. And so both of those are in us. And so the question is, which has supremacy, which comes out in different situations? And how do we work and change the balance? So what is good inside of us has a chance to come out the most. And I think that with something like spiritual practice, it tends to shift the balance. There's other activities we can do that would shift the balance towards Mara nature through this kind of, you know, consumption and greed and hate and all that kind of stuff. So practice changes it for a variety of reasons. But one reason is that I think a lot of the harmful things that humans do to each other comes from not knowing how to be with their own pain. And so once we start learning how to be with our own pain, then we start having other choices, make wiser choices about how to be with that rather than being in reactive mode to it. Also, some of the harmful ways we are in the world with ourselves and others also comes from a relatively coarse level of activity, say in the brain or in the mind. And as we learn to relax the activity of the mind and the coarser levels get quieter, then the more underlying currents, the underlying instincts that we have begin to show themselves more fully. And it's, you know, these are kind of still being speculated, I suppose, but there's a strong, I think there's beginning to be strong evidence, scientific evidence, that we have within us, certainly Mara nature and Buddha nature, but we have very strong instincts towards compassion, for example, and cooperation, not just a competition. And that some of these deeper, some of the deeper, more beautiful things come when we're most relaxed. And when we're most tense, that tends to support, stressed, that tends to support those things that tend to produce conditions of harmfulness to others. So as we do a practice like meditation that calms everything down, then we seem to tap into some of the more beautiful instincts or programming that the mind has. And for example, the programming to compassion or empathy or altruism and all that. And when we're relaxed, we also take in other people in a deeper way. And we register them so that we start taking in people or even strangers in the same way that we maybe take in a close friend or family member. I mean, not like we take them into our home, but the way that the heart or their sensitivity attunes ourselves to them. And so no one becomes a stranger. But if we're tense and running around doing 10,000 things, and someone cuts us off from the freeway, it's so easy to do something unskillful with the fingers, one of our fingers, right? And you don't even think about it. But if you're relaxed and open and sensitive and aware of the other person as a person, you know, you probably offer them your hand rather than your finger, an open hand. So those are some of my kind of impromptu thoughts around this. Yes.
When you say people don't know how to be with their pain.
Sorry?
When you say that people react badly because they don't know how to be with their own pain, what does that mean? How are you with your own pain?
Well, in the simplest way, we learn to be present for it. And a little more complex, we learn not to be reactive to it, pushing it away or denying it or escaping from it. Or taking our pain and then assigning blame elsewhere, or trying to get some kind of relief by distraction, escape, anger. Some people use anger as an escape from their own pain. Recently, last week, I talked to someone who had a great deal of anger, animosity, you know. I was a recipient of it even. And turned out that it was, the person said, you know, the person was really afraid. And somehow the fear was kind of, you know, in some ways inappropriately then expressed outwards in anger. And not knowing how to be with pain is not knowing how to pay attention to it. And not knowing the nature of the reactions and responses. And also not knowing how valuable it is to be very present for our discomfort, for our pain. Often our, almost like a programming is, if there's pain, then it should be fixed. If there's pain, something's wrong, we have to do something. And it's counterintuitive, this idea that it's valuable to maybe not do anything, at least initially, but to actually give ourselves careful time to feel it and be present for it. And many of you probably felt that, you know, if you've in some kind of emotional pain, and some wonderfully kind-hearted person comes and tells you, well, I think you should try this, and this would be really good for you, and this is just a very simple problem. You just kind of arrange these things in your life, and everything will be okay. Here's what you do. And you know, that's not really, you know, and if you have some presence of mind, you might say, you know, that's not what I needed. I just needed someone who was present with me and heard me and really felt what was going on with me. So we can see that with others. It's also true for ourselves to offer that presence. And with that, then, hopefully also comes the opportunity with time to offer some compassion to ourselves or to others. Not more than just being present, but to have some kindness, some goodwill, some acceptance in some deep way for what's going on. And I think that a lot of people, you know, that some of their deeper suffering has to do with the kind of non-acceptance of themselves and of life. And that there's something really wise. There's a wise aspect to acceptance if it's done the right way. There's healthy acceptance that many of us need. So those are some of my thoughts.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, Gil, a little bit, if you could speak a little bit more about the God question. I'm remembering being at a retreat about 8 or 10 years ago, I guess it was, and Christopher Titmus said something about that. I don't remember what he said, though. Somebody asked him that question. He said, oh, yeah, well, it is in the text somewhere. If he said, I don't recall what exactly.
Oh, somewhere in the footnotes of the Buddhist teachings, there's a mention of God?
Yeah, the G word in our... they probably use something. My sense of what he's would have... might have said is that it wouldn't be in the fundamentalist sense, but maybe in the whatever the opposite of Mara sense, in the more symbolic way. Does that make any sense, or is there any reference to something that would kind of at least lean in that direction, not using that terminology, I suppose?
Well, the whole question of God in Buddhism is a big question, and occasionally it's occurred to me to give a whole talk on it, but then I think I'll just bore people. And no one's going to be interested in such a thing. And you don't think so? Should I? And then I'll say something that, and then I might end up saying something which might be offensive to people who are, you know, into God. And so I kind of thought.
You want to avoid the suffering?
What?
You want to avoid that suffering?
Yeah, I want to be careful. So. Well, I don't want to offend people, and I don't want to bore people. And I think I'd probably do one or the other. Is there any other options? It is. We can do a vote. How many of you like a talk some Monday night on Buddhism and God? I won't come that day.
You can make that one of your round robin discussions.
Well, I know how to be present for what I'm uncomfortable with.
We'll watch.
Well, should we do it next? And then they can talk to each other. There's a great Mullah Nasruddin story, where Mullah is a traveling preacher, and he comes to a new place, a new town. They don't know him, and he's going to preach. Gives a wonderful sermon, and he says, stands up on the podium and says, "Does anybody here know?" No. And some of them say, "Yes, we know." And some of them say, "Well, then you tell the others," and then he leaves. And then he goes to the next town, but they've heard what he does. And so he gets up there and says, "Does anybody know?" And he says, and then some people say, "No." And he says, "Well, then it's hopeless." And so he leaves. And then he goes to the third town, and they've heard what he does. And so he starts off by saying, "Does anybody know?" And they say, "Well, some of us do and some of us don't." And he says, "Well, those who know can tell those who don't know." And then he leaves. So should I be brave and foolhardy and talk about God next week? Yeah. Really kind of, you know, go into the topic God and Buddhism?
Mm-hmm.
I know. I'm really yeah. So we have from the fall we have to talk about equanimity. So should we do it before we talk about God or after? Before or after? so okay. Well. I will give serious thought about, probably talk about the Buddhism and God next week and see what that's like and talk about, you know, these abstract conceptual things that, you know, have no relevance for your practice, but if that's what you want. And I'll do my best and talk about this topic. And it's a beautiful topic in some ways because I think the whole God thing is such a, It's such a amazingly broad topic. I mean, how people define what God is, it's so amazingly diverse that you can't have a simple response to it. It's not appropriate because it's, and you have to ask, what do you mean by God? And then, because of this wide range of definitions, I think even the most fundamentalist of atheists will find approve some of the definitions. Because it's so far away from, you know, the idea of the guy with the beard. Sorry? The woman with the beard? Hopefully I'll do it. I'll try next time to do it and do the topic and give some time for questions, comments, protests then. Or somehow, so I, time for me to make amends if I need to. And so, God next week.